A Wednesday Lenten Sermon by Reverend Richard A. Rem, preached at Christ Community Church in Spring Lake, Michigan, on March 26, 2003, entitled, Why Jesus in a World of Religion? Copyright Grand Valley State University. Please note that the original recording spanned two sides of a cassette tape, so there was some missing material. I will bridge the gap.
Maybe we can sense a little bit this evening what must have been experienced at that Last Supper, when Jesus gathered with his disciples for a Passover feast or a feast before the day of preparation, whatever it was, at least a Last Supper, which has become for us the model for our own remembrance at the table of our Lord. Maybe we can sense a little bit what was going on in their minds and hearts, some of the questions they came with and anxieties and fears, because we have them too, don't we? We come here tonight and recognize the contrast between this setting and this space and the intention of this hour and this community, the stark contrast over against what is going on in our world at war. And we have questions and we have anxieties. Certainly with all of our power we will prevail, but it's really not a cakewalk, is it? And there are prisoners of war. And there are people dying, military and civilian. And there's devastation and destruction. And somehow or other, at least I can't get into it. I can't celebrate the victory. I can't rejoice when we score a direct hit. And I don't think that I'm altogether unusual. I got a letter from a parent who has a youngster over there who says, is it right, Dick? I just don't know. Before this war started, I was fairly vocal among my peers opposing any military action with anyone, but now that we've begun, shouldn't we support Bush, Rumsfeld and Tommy Franks? And in this, the most holy of all seasons, are we doing what God wants? Is he happy with what we're doing? Or maybe sad to think that all he's giving us, we're still hung up on might makes right? I'm rambling. And I think the equivocation of a parent who has a child in the midst of it is pretty indicative of the kind of situation in which many of us find ourselves. And maybe that's a pretty good point of identification with the disciples on the night in which he was betrayed, because they must have been wondering what was going on too. What would happen in the morning? What would be the repercussions of that action in the temple court? And what did Jesus really have in mind? And what would happen to them? Would they all alike suffer the same fate? Or would there be some miraculous intervention on the part of God They must have come to that table with a lot of questions and confusion and anxieties and fears. And then it's rather interesting to think about the fact that at a time like that, although it was a part of the Jewish ritual, nonetheless, they came together, that band of brothers. And one wonders what conversations there were among them, and whether they were all focused on one conversation or whether there were several. And then at one point after the meal, Jesus took a towel and a basin and he began to wash their feet. You can scratch that little paragraph about Peter. Peter suffered from foot and mouth disease often. And even the manuscript evidence for that little paragraph is somewhat scrambled. And so don't even worry about that. The intent of this thing is obvious. Having loved his own, he loved them to the fullest extent. He loved them to the end. And at this point when Jesus, if they didn't know what was coming down, certainly he did. At that point, he engaged in this demonstration of the most intimate love, of humility, of service.
And setting them an example that they should do likewise. That's John's narrative of the Last Supper experience.
I don't know if it happened that way or not. There's no foot washing in the Synoptic Gospels in Matthew, Mark, and Luke. And John doesn't have the words of institution, as it were. This is my body, this is my blood. These Gospel writers, they weren't giving us blow-by-blow history. They were painting pictures. They were telling us stories. They were trying to reflect the impact of Jesus on their lives and on their communities. And when John went to write this particular portrayal of the passion of Jesus, he portrayed Jesus in this moment as the servant of all in an expression of magnificent love, of humility and authenticity, as an example for those he knew he was about to leave on their own. This is John's gospel. It's the gospel that begins, "In the beginning was the Word," or the intention. It is the gospel that gives us that which I'm coming back to more and more and more and more and more. That intention takes on human flesh, and that no one has seen God, but that one becomes, again in an interesting translation of the 18th verse, the exegesis of God. No one has seen God, but that one is the interpretation. That one gives the clue to that infinite mystery. This God who so loved the world that he gave this Son. That he gave this Son to save the world. This one now, in the 13th chapter, the beginning of the Passion story. For John, the Eucharist, that bread story, that's back in the 6th chapter, the feeding of the 5,000. That has all kinds of sacramental or Eucharistic references or symbolism. But John doesn't do what Matthew, Mark, and Luke do about that Last Supper. But he does, because John is saying, he's trying to say over and over and over and over again to us, the eternal intention became human, and the human was the expression of the love of God, and that human was the interpretation of that God, and that God manifest in that human being in the night of his betrayal
engaged in an action of concrete love, because in the action of concrete love, in the intimacy of human connection, there God is. There God is experienced. In this anxiety-filled, fear-filled, confused evening, when their minds were all full of their own concern and their own safety and their own future and their own dashed hopes and all of that, Jesus engaged in an act of love. And God was present, and God was experienced. And out of that same community, that Johannine community, come those letters of John. And the first letter begins just like the gospel begins, about this word that we have seen and handled with our hands and our eyes have looked upon, this word that was made flesh. And in the fourth chapter, of course, that thing we come back to again and again, that God is love, and the one who is born of God is the one who loves. It's as though he can't say it enough. No one has ever seen God. There you have it again. This was a community decades after Jesus now. It's this gospel writer who said to Thomas, "Blessed are those who, not having seen, believe." Well, how do you believe in God? How do you experience God? God is a word, a symbol, maybe the figment of our imagination. How can God become real? How can God make any difference to us in this critical moment in the world's history? John was asking the same thing, or trying to express the same thing. No one has ever seen God. But if we love one another, God lives in us, and God's love is perfected in us. God is love, and those who abide in love abide in God, and God abides in them. We love because God first loved us. And if we say, "I love God and I hate my brothers and sisters," the truth is not in me, because how can you love God whom you've not seen if you can't love your brother and sister who are that close to you? It sounds so much like you'd expect to hear in church, doesn't it? What has love got to do with reality? Passage like this can make us feel very guilty, I suppose. Because who loves like that? And after all, it's a rough and tumble world. And if might doesn't make right, at least one likes to have might on one side. How do we respond to this? Certainly, if one is going to even begin, one is going to have to become so self-aware, so painfully self-aware. Because we betray this again and again and again and again. We are so caught up in ourselves, the best of us. So caught up in ourselves, so super sensitive, so easily offended, so easily hurt. We're so caught up in ourselves that how can we possibly reach out and love? And yet that's what we claim this thing is all about. Suppose we can say, well, Jesus was special. So on the night when he's going to be betrayed, the day before his crucifixion, he's able to love his own that way. Well, I don't think it does us any good to feel guilty about it because we fail over and over again. I think it doesn't do us any good to deny the fact that we fail. Certainly doesn't do us any good to go out of here with a load of guilt, because Christian faith is about love and we're human, all too human. The word that's used for love is agape. It's a Greek word. And I had always understood that word to mean that the love flows out of the lover and is not at all drawn by the beloved. I love you even though there's nothing lovable in you. That's the love of God. But Christer Stendahl helped me on that one evening when I raised a question about his interpretation of agape. And he just told me I had been wrong all my life, which is only one area where that's the case. He said, no, love, that is the Greek word agape, is a love that sees value in the other. To be sure, it is a love that flows out of the lover. But it is a love that flows to the other in whom there is value and in whom value is experienced by the love received. There is, in the Greek language, the word philia, which is the brotherly love, sisterly love, good human love, friendship. That's wonderful. There is eros, from which we get our word erotic love, and eros is a perfectly wonderful love. It's a love that desires union and communion. It is the love that keeps us biologically reproducing, and it's wonderful. Eros, the desire for union with the other. But agape is a love that comes out of one, but it comes out of one because one sees value. And one bestows value. And so maybe we shouldn't talk so much about love. Because love is such a complex word and it has so much baggage. And we use it so loosely today. I love pizza. I love this book. I love that music. I love this. I love that. Well, of course the word has lost its seriousness. Maybe we'd be better off to use, how about the word respect? What would happen in the world if we stopped talking about loving one another and began to respect the other? Respect the human being in the diversity of the human situation, where there was the attribution of humanity to the other. Then a love or a respect that comes out from us and embraces the other. And embracing the other enables the other to feel human. And the point of all this is that that kind of love or that kind of respect is the only location for the experience of God, Oh, I know there are some mystics that can go off into the woods or the mountains and have that direct mystical experience. I've never had much luck with that. But it seems to me that John's gospel that hammers away on that incarnation, that embodiment, that hammers away on the love of God, that the letter, the fourth letter, the first letter and that fourth chapter that hammers away on concrete love of brother and sister as the place where God dwells and God is experienced, it seems to me that that's, well, there's a little old song, what the world needs now is love. And what we all need is love as well. And the wonderful thing that happens in a gathering like this, in an hour like this, is that at least for this little bit of time when we're together and we look at each other and in the countenance of the other, we give and we receive the affirmation of our humanity. And here and there, now and again, we really love each other. And we take this bread and this cup, and we remember Jesus, and we remember that in the exigency of his own life, he acted out love in an act of humble service. What would happen if we could begin to humble ourselves enough not only to wash each other's feet, but maybe to begin in a broader circle, at least symbolically, to wash each other's feet, because we really began to act on what we say we believe, and that is that to be human is to be a child of God, and to realize that it is only in the intimate connection and the bond of the human that is possible to know God. If we could only love.